Chapter 18. There's an entire branch of philosophy concerned with the definition of quality, known as aesthetics. Its question, what is meant by beautiful, goes back to antiquity. But when he was a student of philosophy, Phaedrus had recoiled violently from this entire branch of knowledge. He had almost deliberately failed the one course in it he had attended, and had written a number of papers subjecting the instructor and materials to outrageous attack. He hated and reviled everything. It wasn't any particular aesthetician who produced this reaction in him. It was all of them. It wasn't any particular point of view that outraged him, so much as the idea that quality should be subordinated to any point of view. The intellectual process was forcing quality into its servitude, prostituting it. I think that was the source of his anger. He wrote in one paper, "These aestheticians think their subject is some kind of peppermint bonbon they're entitled to smack their fat lips on. Something to be devoured. Something to be intellectually knifed, forked, and spooned up bit by bit with appropriate delicate remarks, and I'm ready to throw up. What they smack their lips on is the putrescence of something they long ago killed." Now, as the first step of the crystallization process, he saw that when quality is kept undefined by definition, the entire field called aesthetics is wiped out. Completely disenfranchised. Kaput. By refusing to define quality, he had placed it entirely outside the analytic process. If you can't define quality, there's no way you can subordinate it to any intellectual rule. The aestheticians can have nothing more to say. Their whole field, definition of quality, is gone. The thought of this completely thrilled him. It was like discovering a cancer cure. No more explanations of what art is. No more wonderful critical schools of experts to determine rationally where each composer had succeeded or failed. All of them, every last one of those know-it-alls, would finally have to shut up. This was no longer just an interesting idea. This was a dream. I don't think anyone really saw what he was up to at first. They saw an intellectual delivering a message that had all the trappings of a rational analysis of a teaching situation. They didn't see he had a purpose completely opposite to any they were used to. He wasn't furthering rational analysis. He was blocking it. He was turning the method of rationality against itself, turning it against his own kind in defense of an irrational concept, an undefined entity called quality. He wrote, 1. Every instructor of English composition knows what quality is. Any instructor who does not should keep this fact carefully concealed, for this would certainly constitute proof of incompetence. 2. Any instructor who thinks quality of writing can and should be defined before teaching it can and should go ahead and define it. 3. All those who feel that quality of writing does exist, but cannot be defined, but that quality should be taught anyway, can benefit by the following method of teaching pure quality in writing without defining it. He then went ahead and described some of the methods of comparison that had evolved in the classroom. I think he really did hope that someone would come along, challenge him, and try to define quality for him. But no one ever did. However, that little parenthetic statement about inability to recognize quality as proof of incompetence did raise eyebrows within the department. He was, after all, the junior member, and not really expected to provide standards quite yet for his senior's performance. His right to say as he pleased was valued, and the senior members actually seemed to enjoy his independence of thought and support him in a church-like way. But contrary to the belief of many opponents of academic freedom, the church attitude has never been that a teacher should be allowed to blather anything that comes into his head without any accountability at all. The church attitude is simply that the accountability must be to the God of reason, not to the idols of political power. The fact that he was insulting people was irrelevant to the truth or falsehood of what he was saying, and he couldn't ethically be struck down for this. But what they were prepared to strike him down for, ethically and with gusto, was any indication that he wasn't making sense. He could do anything he wanted as long as he justified it in terms of reason. But how the hell do you ever justify, in terms of reason, a refusal to define something? Definitions are the foundation of reason. You can't reason without them. He could hold off the attack for a while with fancy dialectical footwork and insults about competence and incompetence, but sooner or later he had to come up with something more substantial than that. His attempt to come up with something substantial led to further crystallization beyond the traditional limits of rhetoric and into the domain of philosophy. Chris turns and flashes a tormented look at me. It won't be long now. Even before we left, there were clues this was coming. When Deweese told a neighbor I was experienced in the mountains, Chris showed a big flash of admiration. It was a large thing in his eyes. He should be done for soon, and then we can stop for the day. Oop, there he goes. He's fallen down. He's not getting up. It was an awfully neat fall, not very accidental looking. Now he looks at me with hurt and anger, searching for condemnation from me. I don't show him any. I sit down next to him and see he's almost defeated. Well, I say, we can stop here, or we can go ahead, or we can go back. Which do you want to do? I don't care, he says. I don't want to. You don't want to what? I don't care, he says angrily. Then since you don't care, we'll keep on going, I say, trapping him. I don't like this trip, he says. It isn't any fun. I thought it was going to be fun. Some anger catches me off guard, too. That may be true, I reply, but it's a hell of a thing to say. I see a sudden flick of fear in his eyes as he gets up. We go on. The sky over the other wall of the canyon has become overcast, and the wind in the pines around us has become cool and ominous. At least the coolness makes it easier hiking. I was talking about the first wave of crystallization outside of rhetoric that resulted from Phaedrus's refusal to define quality. He had to answer the question, if you can't define it, what makes you think it exists? His answer was an old one belonging to a philosophic school that called itself realism. A thing exists, he said, if a world without it can't function normally. If we can show that a world without quality functions abnormally, then we have shown that quality exists, whether it's defined or not. He thereupon proceeded to subtract quality from a description of the world as we know it. The first casualty from such a subtraction, he said, would be the fine arts. If you can't distinguish between good and bad in the arts, they disappear. There's no point in hanging a painting on the wall when the bare wall looks just as good. There's no point to symphonies when scratches from the record or hum from the record player sound just as good. Poetry would disappear, since it seldom makes sense and has no practical value. And, interestingly, comedy would vanish too. No one would understand the jokes, since the difference between humor and no humor is pure quality. Next, he made sports disappear. Football, baseball, games of every sort would vanish. The scores would no longer be a measurement of anything meaningful, but simply empty statistics, like the number of stones in a pile of gravel. Who would attend them? Who would play? Next, he subtracted quality from the marketplace and predicted the changes that would take place. Since quality of flavor would be meaningless, supermarkets would carry only basic grains such as rice, cornmeal, soybeans, and flour. Possibly also some ungrated meat, milk for weaning infants, and vitamin and mineral supplements to make up deficiencies. Alcoholic beverages, tea, coffee, and tobacco would vanish. So would movies, dances, plays, and parties. We would all use public transportation. We would all wear GI shoes. A huge proportion of us would be out of work, but this would probably be temporary until we relocated in essential non-quality work. Applied science and technology would be drastically changed, but pure science, mathematics, philosophy, and particularly logic would be unchanged. Phaedrus found this last to be extremely interesting. The purely intellectual pursuits were the least affected by the subtraction of quality. If quality were dropped, only rationality would remain unchanged. That was odd. Why would that be? He didn't know, but he did know that by subtracting quality from a picture of the world as we know it, he'd revealed a magnitude of importance of this term he hadn't known was there. The world can function without it, but life would be so dull as to be hardly worth living. In fact, it wouldn't be worth living. The term worth is a quality term. Life would just be living without any values or purpose at all. He looked back over the distance this line of thought had taken him, and decided he'd certainly proved his point. Since the world obviously doesn't function normally when quality is subtracted, quality exists, whether it's defined or not. After conjuring up this vision of a qualityless world, he was soon attracted to its resemblance to a number of social situations he had already read about. Ancient Sparta came to mind, communist Russia and her satellites. Communist China, the Brave New World of Aldous Huxley, and the 1984 of George Orwell. He also remembered people from his own experience who would have endorsed this qualityless world. The same ones who tried to make him quit smoking. They wanted rational reasons for his smoking, and, when he didn't have any, acted very superior, as though he'd lost face or something. They had to have reasons and plans and solutions for everything. They were his own kind, the kind he was now attacking. And he searched for a long time for a suitable name to sum up just what characterized them, so as to get a handle on this qualityless world. It was intellectual primarily, but it wasn't just intelligence that was fundamental. It was a certain basic attitude about the way the world was, a presumptive vision that it ran according to laws, reason, and that man's improvement lay chiefly through the discovery of these laws of reason and application of them toward satisfaction of his own desires. It was this faith that held everything together. He squinted at this vision of a qualityless world for a while, conjured up more details, thought about it, and then squinted some more, and thought some more, and then finally circled back to where he was before. Squareness. That's the look. That sums it. Squareness. When you subtract quality, you get squareness. Absence of quality is the essence of squareness. Some artist friends with whom he had once traveled across the United States came to mind. They were Negroes, who had always been complaining about just this qualitylessness he was describing. Square. That was their word for it. Way back, long ago, before the mass media had picked it up and given it natural white usage, they had called all that intellectual stuff square and had wanted nothing to do with it. And there had been a fantastic mismeshing of conversations and attitudes between him and them, because he was such a prime example of the squareness they were talking about. The more he had tried to pin them down on what they were talking about, the vaguer they had gotten. Now, with this quality, he seemed to say the same thing and talk as vaguely as they did, even though what he talked about was as hard and clear and solid as any rationally defined entity he'd ever dealt with. Quality. That's what they'd been talking about all the time. "Man, will you just please kindly dig it?" he remembered one of them saying. "And hold up on all those wonderful $7 questions. If you got to ask what is it all the time, you'll never get time to know." Soul. Quality. The same. The wave of crystallization rolled ahead. He was seeing two worlds simultaneously. On the intellectual side, the square side, he saw now that quality was a cleavage term, what every intellectual analyst looks for. You take your analytic knife, put the point directly on the term quality, and just tap. Not hard, gently. And the whole world splits, cleaves, right in two. Hip and square, classic and romantic, technological and humanistic, and the split is clean. There's no mess, no slop, no little items that could be one way or the other. Not just a skilled break, but a very lucky break. Sometimes the best analysts, working with the most obvious lines of cleavage, can tap and get nothing but a pile of trash. And yet here was quality, a tiny, almost unnoticeable fault line. A line of illogic in our concept of the universe, and you tapped it, and the whole universe came apart so neatly it was almost unbelievable. He wished Kant were alive. Kant would have appreciated it. That master diamond cutter, he would see. Hold quality undefined. That was the secret. Phaedrus wrote, with some beginning awareness that he was involved in a strange kind of intellectual suicide, "Squareness may be succinctly and yet thoroughly defined as an inability to see quality before it's been intellectually defined. That is, before it gets all chopped up into words. We have proved that quality, though undefined, exists. Its existence can be seen empirically in the classroom, and can be demonstrated logically by showing that a world without it cannot exist as we know it. What remains to be seen, the thing to be analyzed, is not quality, but those peculiar habits of thought called squareness that sometimes prevent us from seeing it." Thus did he seek to turn the attack. The subject for analysis, the patient on the table, was no longer quality, but analysis itself. Quality was healthy and in good shape. Analysis, however, seemed to have something wrong with it that prevented it from seeing the obvious. I look back and see Chris is way behind. "Come on!" I shout. He doesn't answer. "Come on!" I shouted again. Then I see him fall sideways and sit in the grass on the side of the mountain. I leave my pack and go back down to him. The slope is steep. I have to dig my feet in sideways. When I get there, he's crying. "I hurt my ankle," he says, and doesn't look at me. When an ego climber has an image of himself to protect, he naturally lies to protect this image. But it's disgusting to see, and I'm ashamed of myself for letting this happen. Now my own willingness to continue becomes eroded by his tears, and his inner sense of defeat passes to me. I sit down, live with this for a while, then, without turning away from it, pick up his backpack and say to him, "I'll carry the packs and relays. I'll take this one up to where mine is, and then you stop and wait with it, so we don't lose it. Then I'll take mine up farther, and then come back for yours. That way you can get plenty of rest. It'll be slower, but we'll get there." But I've done this too soon. There's still disgust and resentment in my voice, which he hears and is shamed by. He shows anger, but says nothing, for fear he'll have to carry the pack again, just frowns and ignores me while I relay the packs upward. I work off the resentment at having to do this by realizing that it isn't any more work for me, actually, than the other way. It's more work in terms of reaching the top of the mountain, but that's only the nominal goal. In terms of the real goal, putting in good minutes, one after the other, it comes out the same, in fact better. We climb slowly upward, and the resentment leaves. For the next hour, we move slowly upward, I carrying the packs and relays, to where I locate the beginning trickle of a stream. I send Chris down for water in one of the pans, which he gets. When he comes back, he says, "Why are we stopping here? Let's keep going." "This is probably the last stream we'll see for a long time, Chris, and I'm tired." "Why are you so tired?" Is he trying to infuriate me? He's succeeding. "I'm tired, Chris, because I'm carrying the packs. If you're in a hurry to take your pack and go on up ahead, I'll catch up with you." He looks at me with another flick of fear, then sits down. "I don't like this," he says, almost in tears. "I hate this. I'm sorry I came. Why did we come here?" He's crying again hard. I reply, "You make me very sorry, too. You better have something for lunch.
I don't want anything. My stomach hurts.
Suit yourself. He goes off a distance and picks up a stem of grass and puts it in his mouth. Then he buries his face in his hands. I make lunch for myself and have a short rest. When I wake up again, he's still crying. There's nowhere for either of us to go. Nothing to do but face up to the existing situation. But I really don't know what the existing situation is. Chris, I say finally. He doesn't answer. Chris, I repeat. Still no answer. He finally says, belligerently,
What?
I was going to say, Chris, that you don't have to prove anything to me. Do you understand that? A real flash of terror hits his face. He jerks his head away violently. I say, You don't understand what I mean by that, do you? He continues to look away and doesn't answer. The wind moans through the pines. I just don't know. I just don't know what it is. It isn't just YMCA egotism that's making him this upset. Some minor thing reflects badly on him, and it's the end of the world. When he tries to do something and doesn't get it just right, he blows up or goes into tears. I settle back into the grass and rest again. Maybe it's not having answers that's defeating both of us. I don't want to go ahead because it doesn't look like any answers ahead. None behind, either. Just lateral drift. That's what it is between me and him. Lateral drift. Waiting for something. Later I hear him prowl at the knapsack. I roll over and see him glaring at me. Where's the cheese? He says. The tone's still belligerent. But I'm not going to give in to it. Help yourself, I say. I'm not waiting on you. He digs around and finds some cheese and crackers. I give him my hunting knife to spread the cheese with. I think what I'm going to do, Chris, is put all the heavy stuff in my pack and the light stuff in yours. That way, I won't have to go back and forth with both packs. He agrees to this, and his mood improves. It seems to have solved something for him. My pack must be about 40 or 45 pounds now, and after we've climbed for a while, an equilibrium establishes itself at about one breath for each step. We come to a rough grade, and it changes to 2 breaths per step. At one bank, it goes to 4 breaths per step. Huge steps, almost vertical, hanging onto roots and branches. I feel stupid because I should have planned my way around this. The aspen staves come in handy now, and Chris takes some interest in the use of his. The packs make you top-heavy, and the sticks are good insurance against toppling over. You plant 1 foot, plant the staff, then swing on it, up and take 3 breaths, then plant the next foot, plant the staff, and swing up. I don't know if I've got any more Chautauqua left in me today. My head gets fuzzy about this time in the afternoon. Maybe I can establish just 1 overview and let it go for today. Way back long ago, when we first set out on this strange voyage, I talked about how John and Sylvia seemed to be running from some mysterious death force that seemed to them to be embodied in technology, and that there were many others like them. I talked for a while about how some of the people involved in technology seemed to be avoiding it too. An underlying reason for this trouble was that they saw it from a kind of groovy dimension that was concerned with the immediate surface of things, whereas I was concerned with the underlying form. I called John's style romantic, mine classic. His was, in the argot of the 60s, hip. Mine was square. Then we started going into this square world to see what made it tick. Data, classifications, hierarchies, cause and effect, and analysis were discussed. And somewhere along there was some talk about a handful of sand, the world of which we're conscious, taken from the endless landscape of awareness around us. I said a process of discrimination goes to work on this handful of sand and divides it into parts. Classical square understanding is concerned with the piles of sand and the nature of the grains and the basis for sorting and interrelating them. Phaedrus's refusal to define quality, in terms of this analogy, was an attempt to break the grip of the classical sand-sifting mode of understanding and find a point of common understanding between the classic and romantic worlds. Quality, the cleavage term between hip and square, seemed to be it. Both worlds used the term, both knew what it was. It was just that the romantic left it alone and appreciated it for what it was, and the classic tried to turn it into a set of intellectual building blocks for other purposes. Now, with the definition blocked, the classic mind was forced to view quality as the romantic did, undistorted by thought structures. I'm making a big thing out of all this, these classical-romantic differences, but Phaedrus didn't. He wasn't really interested in any kind of fusion of differences between those two worlds. He was after something else. His ghost. In the pursuit of this ghost, he went on to wider meanings of quality, which drew him further and further to his end. I differ from him in that I've no intention of going on to that end. He just passed through this territory and opened it up. I intend to stay and cultivate it, and see if I can get something to grow. I think that the referent of a term that can split a world into hip and square, classic and romantic, technological and humanistic, is an entity that can unite a world already split along those lines into one. A real understanding of quality doesn't just serve the system, or even beat it, or even escape it. A real understanding of quality captures the system, tames it, and puts it to work for one's own personal use, while leaving one completely free to fulfill his inner destiny. Now that we're up high on one side of the canyon, we can see back and down and across to the other side. It's as steep there as it is here, a dark mat of greenish-black pines going up to a high ridge. We can measure our progress by sighting against it at what seems like a horizontal angle. That's all the quality talk for today, I guess, thank goodness. I don't mind the quality, it's just that all the classical talk about it isn't quality. Quality is just the focal point around which a lot of intellectual furniture is getting rearranged. We stop for a break and look down below. Chris's spirits seem to be better now, but I'm afraid it's the ego thing again. Look how far we've come, he says. We've got a lot farther to go. Later on, Chris shouts to hear his echo and throws rocks down to see where they fall. He's starting to get almost cocky, so I step up the equilibrium to where I breathe at a good swift rate, about 1.5 times our former speed. This sobers him somewhat, and we keep on climbing. By about 3 in the afternoon, my legs start to get rubbery, and it's time to stop. I'm not in very good shape. If you go on after that rubbery feeling, you start to pull muscles, and the next day is agony. We come to a flat spot, a large knoll protruding from the side of the mountain. I tell Chris this is it for today. He seems satisfied and cheerful. Maybe some progress has been made with him after all. I'm ready for a nap, but clouds have formed in the canyon that appear ready to drop rain. They've filled in the canyon so that we can't see the bottom and can just barely see the ridge on the other side. I break open the packs and get the tent halves out, army ponchos, and snap them together. I take a rope and tie it between the 2 trees, then throw the shelter halves over it. I cut some stakes out of shrubs with the machete and pound them in, then dig a small trench with the flat end of the machete around the tent to drain away any rainwater. We've just got everything inside when the first rain comes down. Chris is in high spirits about the rain. We lie on our backs on the sleeping bags and watch the rain come down and hear its popping sound on the tent. The forest has a misty appearance, and we both become contemplative and watch the leaves of the shrubs jolt when struck by raindrops, and jolt a little ourselves when a clash of thunder comes down, but feel happy that we're dry when everything around us is wet. After a while, I reach into my pack for the paperback by Thoreau, find it, and have to strain a little to read it to Chris in the gray, rainy light. I guess I've explained that we've done this with other books in the past, advanced books that he wouldn't normally understand. What happens is I read a sentence, he comes up with a long series of questions about it, and then, when he's satisfied, I read the next sentence. We do this with Thoreau for a while, but after half an hour I see to my surprise and disappointment that Thoreau isn't coming through. Chris is restless, and so am I. The language structure is wrong for the mountain forest we're in. At least that's my feeling. The book seems tame and cloistered, something I'd never have thought of Thoreau, but there it is. He's talking to another situation, another time, just discovering the evils of technology, rather than discovering the solution. He isn't talking to us. Reluctantly, I put the book away again, and we're both silent and meditative. It's just Chris and me in the forest and the rain. No books can guide us anymore. Pans we've set outside the tent begin to fill up with rainwater, and later, when we have enough, we pour it all together in a pot and add some cubes of chicken bouillon and heat it over a small sterno stove. Like any food or drink after a hard climb in the mountains, it tastes good. Chris says, I like camping with you better than with the Sutherlands. The circumstances are different, I say. When the bouillon is gone, I get out a can of pork and beans and empty it into the pot. It takes a long time to heat up, but we're in no hurry. It smells good, Chris says. The rain has stopped, and just occasional drops pat down on the tent. I think tomorrow will be sunny, I say. We pass the pot of pork and beans back and forth, eating from opposite sides. Dad, what do you think about all the time? You're always thinking all the time. Oh, all kinds of things. What about? Oh, about the rain, and about troubles that can happen, and about things in general. What things? Oh, about what it's going to be like for you when you grow up. He's interested. What's it going to be like? But there's a slight ego gleam in his eyes as he asks this, and the answer as a result comes out masked. I don't know, I say. It's just what I think about. Do you think we'll get to the top of this canyon by tomorrow? Oh, yes. We're not far from the top. In the morning? I think so. Later he is asleep, and a damp night wind comes down from the ridge, causing a sighing sound from the pines. The silhouettes of the treetops move gently with the wind. They yield and then return, then with a sigh yield and return again, restless from forces that are not part of their nature. The wind causes a flutter of one side of the tent. I get up and peg it down, then walk on the damp spongy grass of the knoll for a while, then crawl back into the tent and wait for sleep.